And joining us from the nation's capital, we welcome U.S. Senator Mike Crapo. Senator, it's good to have you. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, Neil. Hope you guys are doing well, too.
Well, we are. We know August is hot, it's humid, it's muggy in the nation's capital, and I'm sure there's a lot of lawmakers eager to get out of town. But there are enough of you that are saying we're not leaving until we address especially the SAVE Act and some of these other issues. So I guess give us a status update on what's happening right now.
Well, you're right. And, you know, the August recess is one where members, first of all, those who are campaigning are quite anxious to get out of town because they're in races and their opponents are out there attacking them. But it's also a very extensive work period for members of Congress. Often it's called a vacation, but it's an extensive work period. So there's a lot of intense concern about whether we stay here or not. I'm one of those, as you've indicated, that says we should stay here and get the SAVE Act done. The way that we can do that, since we don't have the votes, as we've talked before in the Senate, to get rid of the filibuster, is, and the president has agreed to this approach, is we can use a new reconciliation bill. You know very well that's one where we can do a bill without the filibuster, but it's subject to very specific rules.
Yeah.
And the rules are that you have to be either an entitlement spending of some sort or tax policy, and there's a way to use mandatory spending to incentivize or give grants to states that would facilitate them implementing the provisions of the State Act, of the SAVE Act. And the president's agreeable to letting that be what we take as our first step, as I understand it anyway. And so we are now working to put together that reconciliation bill. The House has done it. They've passed a bill to do so. They put $10 billion in their bill. It was also a bill that adds another $60 billion for our national defense because the Democrats have literally refused to even do the National Defense Authorization Act this year. And so we are now trying to put that together. I don't know whether we will get that done or not, but there are many of us who are saying we need to stay here and vote to get that done.
Senator, I you know, you look at this and reconciliation appears to be the only possible path right now for that. But you have some senators who are in some pretty tight places, like Senator Collins up in Maine. You've got some others as well. I think the relationship with Cornyn and Tillis with anything the president wants could be complicated as well. Do you feel confident that the Senate would get to 50 with this, something similar to this reconciliation bill passed in the House?
I cannot tell you that I'm absolutely confident that we would, because of what you've just said. There are some senators who are against the SAVE Act, and they're just openly against it, and you've mentioned some of them. We don't know. We are going to, I'm sure, whip that, but we've got plenty of other battles going on right now. We've got a lot of other battles going on right now for the next week or so that may interrupt that, but we've got to check it out. And the way we do that is we whip it through the whip team. I'm the vice chair of the whip team, and we will go out to every member and find out exactly where they are. I do believe that it's going to be tough. As you know, Mitch McConnell is out, and he would be a no vote anyway, probably. And we also have some circumstances where there's one or two others who are out. And because of that, we are down to pretty much one vote that we can lose and still get to a 50-50 tie. I'm not saying we can't get there yet, but you raised a very valid question that I just don't know the answer to, because there's enough that we've got to convince who don't have allegiance to President Trump anymore and who are in a political race where they can't do it. And so it's going to be dicey.
Well, Senator, you mentioned Mitch McConnell. I'm going to ask you a question about that. Do you have an opinion on what should happen there? Because currently he's not really functioning as an effective senator. Is it time for him to step down? Does there need to be something done, especially when this important legislation is happening and we're missing a Republican vote there, no matter which way he would vote?
I think that's a decision that is personal to him. He's made it clear to us that he is mentally capable and competent, and he's rehabilitating. This is not an unusual situation. Unfortunately, we've seen many cases in the past where a senator has been ill or incapacitated in some way, and sometimes they are gone for months. And you know, people haven't in the past called for them to resign or anything like that, and I'm certainly not doing that. I think that we just need to wait this out with Mitch and deal with the reality of what it poses. I know a lot of people who are mad at him are putting pressure on right now to say, well, he should be forced to resign. I'm not one of those. I think that he should be given the opportunity to heal and come back if he wants to do so.
I know there's been some talk, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but there's a certain date in August, apparently, where it's going to change how that seat gets replaced. Is there a sense that maybe they're kind of running out the clock to get to that date so that it's more favorable in selecting his replacement?
There is a lot of talk about, I shouldn't say it's talk with me. I'm not one of those who's engaged in those conversations. But I'm confident that there's a lot of analysis going on as to whether, if he is replaced, what the timing should be because of just of the law in his state in Kentucky and who would get to make that announcement. I mean, if we turned that seat over to the Democrats, that would not be a smart move. And so we've got to be really careful about what we do here if we go down that road. And as I say, I'm not one who thinks we should go down that road yet. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a decision we leave up to Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
All right, let's chat about something else. I was doing some research about the work that's been going on in Washington, and you were part of, you actually led the Taxpayer Assistance and Service Act. This is 60 provisions that just kind of revamp IRS operations, streamlining a little bit. Would you let our listeners know what benefit this would be to them, the streamlining of these IRS operations?
Yes, this has been touted as one of the most significant IRS reforms bills in history. I mean, there's two or three other critical IRS reforms bills that happened over the years, but this one is getting an incredibly positive response. And essentially, it modernizes IRS operations. As I've indicated to you, we have a national taxpayer advocate position, which is not subject to the IRS. It's not an IRS position. But it's a national taxpayer advocate who analyzes the IRS, receives complaints from people about how the IRS is treating them, and looks at all kinds of other aspects of the management and operation of the IRS. And this national taxpayer advocate every year puts out a report. And their report always has dozens and dozens and dozens of improvements to IRS operations that they recommend. And we took those reports and picked out about 60 really important things. It modernizes the IRS, it strengthens taxpayers' rights, it makes the tax system easier to navigate, refunds will be speeded up and made faster, the IRS will respond more quickly, it digitizes our return system so we don't have this deal where we're doing paperwork these days. Agencies that work through paperwork these days are way in the past. It upgrades IRS accounts. It improves and strengthens their technological operations and their callback options, and it protects victims of fraud from the IRS indefinitely scrutinizing them. I mean, they become victimized again by the IRS. So there's just a list that, you know, you said it's 60 different items, but this is just tuning up the IRS, making it more taxpayer-friendly, make it more technologically operational, and just making the whole system of dealing with the IRS much less stressful for Americans.
Senator Crapo, let's shift to immigration for a couple of minutes here. I know that Senator Curtis from Utah has introduced a bill that would actually create a state-sponsored visa proposal, and it would give a lot more latitude to the states overseeing, you know, the presence of immigrants in their own states. And a lot of people are saying it's a form of amnesty because it would allow someone who came here illegally to stay. But he added that it would create a lot of requirements for them to be able to do that. we all know that this problem, specifically with immigration, having a supply of labor for agriculture and related industries is an important issue, but the law is important as well. And so I'd love for you to respond about how you feel about Senator Curtis's proposal. It seems like it's getting quite a bit of pushback from other Republicans.
Yeah, it is getting a lot of pushback, and I have not, to be honest with you, I have not focused on it closely, so I can't talk about it in a lot of detail, but I understand the issue very well, and that issue, as you've just described it, take Idaho, for example. People in Idaho do not want illegal aliens being able to just come across the border without consequence, and they want us to deal with that. On the other hand, they also believe we should have a working guest worker program that allows people to come across the border and work in our fields, particularly in our agriculture. That's critical for our agriculture. So I think what his bill is trying to do is to go about it in a different way from the guest worker program, and or maybe a adjunct to the guest worker program, and say we ought to let states have the right to decide whether those who came across illegally but are now working in our fields and are honorable citizens in that sense. They're citizens, obviously, but are working and they are not the criminal element. Should the states be allowed to make those decisions? And that's a tough one. I'd be glad letting Idaho have that right, but I'm not sure I'd be glad letting California have that right. And so
yeah.
I have some real concerns.
Yeah. Well, and does it create sort of a jurisdictional mess, too? Because immigration is clearly a federal issue and there are federal laws that have been violated. So how do you then convert that into a patchwork of different state regulations? It seems like it's very clunky.
I agree. You put your finger on it. And we've seen this in so many different other parts of the law, where states, and I used California as an example, and they are the lead example every time, but there are many other states that that will basically force our whole country to go into a different type of system because of their policies that they utilize. And I'll jump from immigration to another issue. I mean, California and some of these other states are all looking at trying to operate our Medicaid system, for example. You know, states have the right to have significant impact on Medicaid systems, and these states are driving up Medicaid fraud in massively aggressive ways that really impacts our national Medicaid system. And so, yes, the answer that you ask is yes, that poses a real problem in the immigration world.
All right, let's do a follow-up to that, because I know you have called for improvements to the guest worker program, the H-2A program. That was a hot topic in the Idaho legislature this year. I'm sure it's going to be again next year. I don't think that that's going away. What improvements are you calling for?
Well, first and foremost, we need to create an increased size of the guest worker program. We have limits on the number of people who can come legally across the border, and those limits are far short of what we need for workers. And so we need to address that. Secondly, we need to address the workers who are already here, sort of the question that Senator Curtis, I think, is trying to address, only not in a way that I would agree to. And we would, in the bill, we would need to find a way to address the fact that they are here illegally now, and to grant them amnesty is not the right solution. So it's tricky, but we need to find a way that they can return home and come back legally, or that they can get a status while they work out penalties for having illegally come across the border, and something that can be politically acceptable. So I don't know the answer to that yet, but that's a piece of it that has to be addressed. One of the biggest pieces, though, is what I mentioned to start with. We have to dramatically expand the focus of that program so that the pressure to come across the border illegally is reduced, because you can have a smooth pathway, if you're an honorable person, to be vetted and come across the border legally. And it's just eliminating those roadblocks and eliminating the caps on the number of people who are allowed, which I think would dramatically reduce the actual illegal immigration.
All right, we'll leave it at that. Senator Crapo, as always, thank you for your time. It's good to chat with you, and perhaps you'll be in recess by this time next week. So maybe a few weeks before we chat with you again.
Well, we'll see. If we're here, I'd be glad to visit with you.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Senator. It's 7.